It is Friday, March 24th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell. Welcome to Geek Speak. We work every week to bridge the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Today on Geek Speak, after a spot of geek news, we're talking with Philip Terrone, associate editor of Make Magazine, a new O'Reilly publication, a wonderful magazine and movement, I'd want to say. During the second half of the show, I'm going to welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. I'm going to try to stay on topic today, though, so please call in if you want to join the conversation about Make Magazine. And please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the room with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta, Drew Meyer, Storage Specialist at AdaptTech, and over the line via Skype is Dee Dee Hubbard, a student of technology and art at NYU. Welcome, Dee Dee. And welcome, geeks, to Geek Speak.
Hey. Hello.
Good morning.
So before we get into our conversation and have from Seattle have Philip join us about Make Magazine, let's do a little bit of geek news. And Sean, I'm going to start with you, sir.
Yeah, Intel shipped 64-bit Pentium 4s this week. Very exciting. Pretty cool. These new 90 nanometer chips are, which means they have smaller transistors in them, actually can now contain 2 megabytes of L2 cache instead of 512K. So that's 4 times the amount of cache, onboard cache on these chips.
And this is a 64-bit processor.
Correct. This is the 6XX series. The Pentium 4 630 will be at 3 gigahertz, the 640 at 3.2 gigahertz, 650 at 3.4, and 660 at 3.6 gigahertz.
Now, these are the Intel 64-bits that kind of took the AMD model of making them be able to run normal 32-bit software?
No.
Okay, so
these
are
using Intel 64-bit code.
So it's
very similar to AMD 64-bit code, but did not borrow from it officially.
Okay, so but does that mean you can you install a 30?
I'm just saying it's all the same though, right? It all runs 64-bit Windows and Linux.
So I can't tell the difference.
Can you run 32-bit software or operating system on it?
Yes, that is the key to this 64-bit line of Pentiums. Unlike their Itanium processor, which is 64-bit. It does not run Windows. This 64-bit Pentium 4 line does run regular 32-bit Windows. So if you've got Windows XP and, well, of course, you can't. There's 64-bit Windows is not available yet, although you can download it, and you'll get a year from Microsoft before you have to pay for
kind
it.
Kind of the beta version.
It's a beta version.
And, of course, you could install Linux 64-bit on this.
So this is really nice. If you really want to go 64-bit at some point, this would be a great buy. You can install Windows XP now, use it, and then when you get 64-bit Windows, upgrade later.
All right.
Now, also, these chips have 800 megahertz front-side bus. Very fast. And the Pentium 4 Extreme Edition, I don't know what the model number is. It's just the 6X. Yeah, they don't say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a 1,066 megahertz front-side bus, and it runs at 3.73 gigahertz. So if you want the end-all, be-all chip right now, that might be the way to go.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Dee Dee, I want to go to you, actually, in New York.
Hey.
Hey. Got a news item for us today?
I got some news about Flickr and Yahoo. Yahoo recently acquisitioned Flickr, which is a photo sharing website, kind of along the lines of album sharing and social networking. And on top of it all, they're opening up a new search beta for Creative Commons licensed public works. So it's work by somebody else that is kind of open sourced in a way. You're allowed to make use of it or make derivatives from it. It's a new way of finding content to use in your own creative media.
So that means that basically you'll be able to say, I want to get some free images that have this kind of, that have a dog in them, and you'll be able to find those images and know that you can use them because it's a Creative Commons
right.
license. That's pretty nice. I like that. And thank you very much for that update. Drew?
Okay. Good morning, Lyle. Let's see. Thing I want to talk about this morning, first off, is Mozilla and the new Firefox fix. Firefox flaw fix, right?
What was the flaw?
There was a flaw in the browser software. Everybody knows that Firefox is a common, a browser that we really favor on the show and think is a good secure method to get on the internet. They found a patch, or they found a flaw where you could have a potentially a buffer overrun attack as a result of opening picture images that contain rogue code. So the new version is 1.0.2. It fixes the potential threat. It's a free download. It's essentially a patch. I think this is the second patch that they've ever released since going live with this, going public. And it's just another way to keep ahead of what's going on and safe on the internet.
Cool. Thank you very much. Sean?
Yeah, top executive at Sony has said that they may unite Blu-ray and HD DVD standards, which are the next generation optical DVD standard that they can hold more data. Quite a bit more data, upwards of 25 to 30 gigabytes of data. So far, HD DVD, backed by NEC and Toshiba, have doing a pretty good job of getting their stuff ready. What's nice about that, HD DVD is backwards compatible with current DVDs and CDs, and they've got some movie titles and movie houses on board. Not as many as Sony, though, who's using Blu-ray technology that has greater capacity. A lot of people aren't very happy that there'd be two standards.
Right.
Nobody wants to have to go through that again. So this is good talk. Hopefully they can do
this. Hopefully merge this together.
Same kind of thing happened with Dash R, M Plus R DVD recordable technologies. Eventually they were able to produce chips that could write both.
Right.
But still, you know, when you go to the store, you got to figure out which media you want.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks. Keep us apprised of that. The Blu-ray technology. I'm going to cover a story about George Lucas. See, when Episode 1 of Star Wars came out, George Lucas was really pushing for digital projection, and he kind of helped launch a whole bunch of digital theaters. So they have the ability to download films to large hard drives and project them digitally. And when I first saw it, you know, it was kind of pixely, but it was very bright, and it was clear, if you will. But
I hear it's so much better if you go to a digital theater.
Yeah, well, the digital theater, I mean, I was kind of back and forth on it. I think one of the great things about it is you're not printing all of these films and passing them around. Instead, they're downloading them. So the distribution of films will be quite easy if we get into this. Now George Lucas, along with other people that are very involved in this, are advocating 3D projection. And that basically means a projector that can have 3D. It's not like the color one where you have a red and a blue lens, but you do have to wear glasses. And the general thought is that he's going to be re-releasing all the Star Wars films processed, post-processed, to be 3D. So basically there's software that you can identify stuff that's closer in the scene versus farther away and emulate 3D or create the film in 3D. And supposedly it works. It's really quite beautiful. And a lot of people are using a lot of, you know, big film names. Jackson, Lord of the Rings, it says that he's done a test.
Okay, now that would be cool.
He's done a test.
I've seen Star Wars so many times,
yeah,
just to see new stuff, you know.
So I guess Jackson actually took the Lord of the Rings and Gollum and some of the dust effects and stuff really are 3D. So he was able to do a screening of it where Gollum actually comes out at you a little bit.
Wow.
Kind of neat. But, of course, it's a massive interest to change over to 3D projections, a massive infrastructure.
Right, change, right.
You know, a lot of work.
So I bet you they'll be introducing that in major cities first.
Yeah, I would say just kind of like the digital video projection.
So you're saying that 20-year-old printed film is going to be converted to digital and run through this software and reprocessed and then re-released as three-dimensional. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, hopefully it will look good and not cartoonish. So I'm going to do one more news story. Who's got the best one?
Well,
Drew? Sean?
Okay, I've got one about...
Let's go with Drew.
All right, Novell and Linux Desktop 10.
Linux? Nah.
Nah?
Sean?
Wait a minute.
No,
okay,
go
ahead.
No, I'm kidding.
Novell. You're breaking me down. I got an iSCSI one here. That gets me excited.
You tell people about Linux.
Yeah,
that's
go ahead.
Pretty big because they're saying they're going to take out Microsoft.
Well, this is a pretty... I agree. This is a pretty big statement they're saying. They're planning to go head-to-head with Windows in the corporate environment, which is something we've all been, you know, looking for and excited about for a long time. And these guys believe that they finally got the product ready to do it. It's called Linux Desktop 10. It takes the application suite out of specific workgroup targets and puts it into mainstream enterprises so that you can do word processing, you can do email, you've got software that looks and behaves and works interoperably with Microsoft products, yet it's not Microsoft-based. It's open
which
source
means
Linux.
It's a lot cheaper, I would assume, to get this product.
And I think the other thing that a corporate IT personnel will be excited about is the security and the maintenance challenges.
Right.
You're not going to have so many viruses. You're not going to have so many patches and updates to produce. Make sure that your users are all managed and on the same version and at the safest level. So that's exciting. It's going to include a search feature called Beagle and a note-taking technology called Tomboy. Kind of cool little features. We'll see how well they're adopted, if it makes any difference. But then you can jump on your computer and have a search engine built right in so you can find your last PowerPoint presentation no matter where you stashed it away. That happens to me occasionally. Very seldom, right?
All right. Well, cool. Thank you very much for that update.
Geagle?
Beagle.
Like a dog.
I was thinking about that, right? It sniffs out the files that are lost somewhere.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. With me in the air room are Sean Cleveland and Drew Mayer. And from New York via the internet is Dee Hubbard. Thank you, geeks, for joining us. We're now going to switch over a little bit. The O'Reilly Hack series of books, by O'Reilly, major production of great computer books. My collection grows all the time for programmers and developers. They've launched, I guess, about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, this Hack series, which is basically this really great idea of showing new ways to use technology. And I'm not saying that Make Magazine came from that, but it shows the kind of the feeling, the corporate feeling in O'Reilly. You know, you give tools for people to develop stuff. Pretty exciting. Now, Make Magazine brings the do-it-yourself mindset to all the technology in your life. So Make is loaded with, it's a magazine, it's a really thick magazine that's loaded with all these projects and cool things to do. And after seeing the kind of preview release, I was like, gotta have these people on the show. Totally cool. They also have a wonderful website, make.oreilly.com, that is run and managed by Philip Terone, who is our guest today. Philip, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on such short notice. I really appreciate it. I know that the person we were trying to get on, I guess one of the founders, has a flu, and so you're kind of filling in. But I'm glad to talk with you because I really do appreciate that Make website, especially right now while I'm kind of waiting for the next issue of the magazine.
Oh, no problem.
So first, real briefly, why did O'Reilly launch Make? How'd that happen?
Well, you know, O'Reilly had their start as computer book publishers, and when you look at kind of the genesis of where they came from, writing about Unix. A lot of things about Unix were hidden and no one knew about. And if you wanted to find out about it, you'd get this cryptic manual. And O'Reilly, you know, ran around and they talked to the actual experts, the real people in the field. And I think that's where Make kind of gets its start. The same thing as you mentioned at the Hack series. Make is kind of like that. You know, there's people out there making incredible things and they're doing really innovative things. And the people who are making things are actually usually the ones that later on, you know, the industry kind of pays attention to. I mean, you probably remember people running around making their own Wi-Fi hotspots, you know, years and years ago, and now all of a sudden it's a business, and, you know, everyone has it, and they're all in laptops, and they're everywhere. But a lot of these started, a lot of these projects, a lot of these ideas started out in someone's head, and it was just a project. And so that's what Make kind of celebrates, is this edge case, these groups of people who go out and build things, and also we're at a point where there's so much electronics and people really aren't using them anymore. There's, you know, you can only do so many things with your digital camera. Well, maybe you can put it on a kite, or maybe right. You can, you know, learn how to make 3D photos. So that's kind of the way we look at things.
Let's talk about that article that just came out in your first preview release, kind of took over the cover. Was a wonderful article on making kite photography setup for, you know, doing aerial photography. And it's cheap and easy and kind of a cool project to do. I would say if you have a 15-year-old or younger, you know, 12-year-old kid and you have some time, what a fun project to do. It kind of gives you all the tools. Who wrote it? Is it someone on staff? Or, you know, how do you get people involved in writing these articles?
We actually went out and, you know, talked to experts. And, you know, in general, there's kite aerial photography around the globe. And so, you know, we, of course, you know, we have our editorial fingerprints on it, but, you know, we had Charles Benton do this, and he's from the Berkeley CAP organization, and I think his website is arc.ced.berkeley.edu/CAP. It's also on magazine.com. Mm-hmm. So we always get the experts, and he has a really great article, and it shows how to take the disposable digital cameras and make this little rig, and you can fly it up to 25 to 250 feet and snap pictures, and the pictures really turn out great. And there's some great photographs that we put in the magazine that just show, you know, some of the things that you can do with the kite project.
It's the project. Yeah, I like that you showed some of the photographs to really show that, you know, it's very, very feasible. I wish I had less trees around my house because I'd be doing aerial photography around my house.
Yeah.
You do have to go into a clear area. I guess the next one might be, you know, get a blimp and do aerial photography with a blimp. But basically, this rig is the way it's designed is, you know, pretty simple. You get some wood together, you get some string, and you have to have some silly putty for the timer. But yeah. Basically, you take one of those disposable cameras that are really quite light, and, you know, it doesn't really matter that much if it gets destroyed after you develop the film, it's gone anyway.
Yeah.
And you just kind of get you wind up the spring that has a silly putty in it and wait for it to go off. And while it's spinning slowly to trigger the camera, you're, of course, hoping the kite will fly. Did you build one of these? Did you get involved in it at all?
I have built some in the past. I'm never satisfied with projects, and I always have to, you know, do something a little bit different. I actually used a digital camera
mm-hmm.
for mine, and I soldered in a chip, and the chip would just take photos every few seconds. So using the same techniques, I did this, but I had an extra digital camera laying around, and out here in Seattle where I'm at, it was pretty windy, so I had enough lift to get it up, and so I took some pictures.
So that means you get a whole collection of photos and you do it right away without having to develop them.
Yeah, it's just because I'm impatient.
Yeah, my only digital cameras, I'm not going to be putting on the kite. Too expensive.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about some of the articles that are coming up for Make Magazine. What's an exciting one that's going to be kind of your feature cover story for your next issue?
Well, our next issue, each time we have a theme, you know, the first one, the theme was aerial photography, but that was just one article, you know, that was our kind of cover shot. The next one is home entertainment.
Nice.
And the article that I'm just finishing up that I'm pretty excited about is podcasting, how to do it, everything about it, and just basically, you know, everything you need to know if you want to get into it. And so I'm excited about that one. The other one I'm excited about is from Joe Grand. He wrote turning an Atari 2600 into a PC, which is great. So if you want to, if you have an old Atari 2600 laying around, you could turn that into a PC and use it as your regular desktop computer.
Wait, he used the console and put new stuff inside of it?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So it's just the form factor and the keyboard and such of it.
There's some other surprises with it too.
Cool, nice.
Yeah, he did a really awesome job on it. It's pretty incredible.
it's funny that you mentioned podcasting. I wish I'd had that article before I put the podcast up of GeekSpeak. I just recently finally got an RSS 2 feed with GeekSpeak. So if you're interested in downloading GeekSpeak regularly, you can learn more about what from the magazine, what podcasting is. It's kind of cool. And it's a different way of producing media and distributing media. So that should be a good article. Now, you were the one that wrote the article?
Yes. From start to finish, I wanted to give everyone an overview because I get asked it a lot, like, what is it? How do I do it? And what do I need? What tools do I need on a Mac or a PC? How do I... how do I make an MP3 file? You know, all the way from the basic things all the way up until, you know, what you said, I mean, getting an RSS 2.0 feed, what aggregators or what podcast applications work and how to download it, and even tips on interviewing people.
It's interesting that makes around. For quite a while, we've been seeing and kind of highlighting different crazy projects that people do. I remember a guy that his kid wanted one of those drivable cars, you know, that has power in it. So he went and put together a tank and made the whole thing and documented it all online. And it's like perfect thing that, you know, kind of crazy, kind of fun. And then he self-documented is pretty neat. And now to have kind of a magazine that kind of highlights these is kind of exciting because, of course, it's more tangible.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we have some fun things that we can do online. We cover articles and links to lots of the projects that go on. And then some of them kind of graduate themselves up into the magazine, where you need, you know, 20 or 30 pages of content that you can just kind of lay out the magazine and start doing your project. That's one of the things that I know you mentioned in the top of the show. It's a big magazine. It's technically a book, I guess, because it has an ISBN. We call it a MOOC, half magazine, half book. But there's almost 200 pages per issue. And that's a lot of room for projects. That's one of the things that we really like about the format is you can really get a good overview of a picture. Like the kite project, for instance, that we were talking about before, you really need a lot of pages, and you know how all the pictures are laid out and how everything is a step-by-step. It really helps the format well.
Yeah. I think I've learned quite well that the having the book or having something in hand in paper form when you're doing projects, very important. Even when you're programming, I mean, I do a lot of development, and you know, you can find all the resources and all the references and documentation online for free, no problem. But there's nothing
like having a good book to help you along the process. I use, you know, like O'Reilly books, for example, for references all the time. So I like that it's in a tangible medium. Let me hear another article, another issue coming up, another project that's coming up on the next issue of Make.
Well, I can even give you a preview of our third issue, which is kind of exciting.
Why not?
Why not? The third issue, the theme is automotive, and we have some interesting things. And one of the projects I'll be writing up soon is how to Wi-Fi a bus. So let's say if you want to turn a bus into or a large caravan or whatever you have that you want to put a lot of people, how do you get everybody on there onto a Wi-Fi system, a portable hotspot?
So that's nice. How do you get them connected?
Well, you got to subscribe to the magazine.
Nice tangle.
Hey, okay, you just launched. You got the premiere issue. You got more issues coming. I guess it's four a year. How's it going?
It's going. It's exceeded all expectations. I think, this is a little bit of a bold idea. When I really like something and I really think something's a good idea, generally that means it's really geeky, and that means that it might be something that not tons and tons of people would really embrace. But contrary to that, it turns out that this was a magazine and this was an effort that a lot of people really wanted to see. So we've been floating in the top 10 on Amazon subscriptions. We're doing another printing already of the magazine.
Of your first issue.
Yeah, and the press has been great, and it's been really well received. And our peers who never pull any punches, they've given us some great.
It's amazing how many people are doing this kind of thing.
Okay, your blog is unbelievable.
Yeah, the blog is great.
Just yesterday, I was explaining to a guy Make Magazine. I tell him, listen to the show. It's going to be pretty interesting. And I told him about the kite camera. And he said, I took my son, and we actually built a model rocket camera. And he actually got it to work. So that when the model rocket deploys a parachute, the camera started taking pictures.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it was too high, and the camera was too low of quality. So they got the pictures, but you just couldn't make anything out.
So is he picking up an issue of Make? And
I don't know. Maybe. I hope.
Yeah, let's talk. Drew, you just mentioned the blog that Philip manages, and that's at make.oreilly.com. You can get to it from geekspeak.org, of course. And I like the top post. It's talking about the show right now.
Yeah.
But basically, you've got a whole bunch of things that I'm assuming these small kind of interesting things to do aren't going to be in the magazine. This is kind of addition to the magazine?
Yeah, there's some things. I'll give you an example. That there's stories that I like to follow. There's a fellow who's been trying to pitch the idea to Pez to make a Pez MP3 player. Really great idea. When you think about it, it's obvious. You know, the Pez candy dispenser form factor should be an MP3 player. And so for years, for almost...
I'm sorry, wait. That wasn't that obvious to me until I read your post.
As long as you can get Pez candies from it still. If you can still get Pez candies, then it's cool.
Still dispenses that yummy fructose.
Are you saying it's clearly a good form factor because there's so many cases for it?
Yeah, well, yeah. That, and, you know, you can put different heads on it. And it's just
That is a great idea.
And so I've been following this for a long time, so... he finally inked a deal with them. It looks like he's actually going to produce these. He's going to do a limited run. He got the approval from Pez, and he's going to do it. So I like following stories like that, and that's something, you know, we'll probably have something in the magazine eventually, but it's an ongoing story that I just like to cover. The other thing, Radio Shack just came out with a new set of robots called the Vex Robot Kit, and, you know, that's something that we'll take a look at later, but I wanted to get the word out now because I like that Radio Shack is starting to return a little bit back to their heritage of having
that is people
to build stuff. Yeah,
they should be very involved with this.
Yeah, and you know, simple things. There's a solar death ray.
I saw that.
you have to see the photos in action to really appreciate it. So someone had taken I think 112 mirrors, all angled them towards one specific spot, and you can get up to, you know, 500 or 600 degrees Celsius, and pretty much burn or melt anything. Kind of fascinating. And, you know, we cover lots of other things, from PlayStation portable things that folks are doing now to little projects that are out there. I mean, I kind of think as magazine.com as the aggregator of lots of cool do-it-yourself projects that are out there that, you know, we won't necessarily cover in the magazine, but they are a good read. One of the ones I really liked recently was I linked to a site called English Cut, and it's about a tailor, And this guy just has this website, and he just talks about how he makes suits in London. And the more I read it, the more I was fascinated. And then someone from Slate actually pointed out probably why I was fascinated by it, is because it's engineering, and it's structure, and it's physics, and there's all sorts of geometry and materials and everything. It's like, oh, yeah, this is like, you know, this is a geek thing. So I thought it was neat to you know, point over to that.
They have the Gauss rifle online.
Yeah.
That is cool. Lyle was showing that to me at breakfast a couple of weeks ago. We were poring over Make Magazine. And the Gauss rifle, with the magnets, how you can make them more powerful as they go along.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Let's cover that in good just idea. A second. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online, of course, at santacruzelectronics.com. We're talking with Philip Tyrone about Make Magazine, The Geeks This Morning. I'm Lyle Troxell, Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland. We also have Dee Dee from New York. And we're talking all about Make Magazine. And now's your time to call in to ask questions and comments about Make Magazine or about this kind of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
This Week in This American Life. The rather surprising account of how a Palestinian teenager, a suicide bomber, ends up in a long conversation about the whole thing with the very head of Israel's defense forces. What they say to each other, and what they never can understand about each other. And other stories about knowing your enemy. This week, from Public Radio International.
That's This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m., right after Car Talk, on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
The Bolivarian Circle International and Cuba Study Group of Santa Cruz County presents the Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution Film Festival, featuring The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m., Saturday, April 10th, at the Live Oak Grange, located at 1900 17th Avenue in Santa Cruz. For information, call 331-5844.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks This Morning, Sean Cleveland, Drew Meyer, Dee Dee Hubbard, and our guest, Philip Tyrone of Make Magazine. We're talking about Make Magazine and do-it-yourself projects. Please join our conversations. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can visit the Internet, go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And we'll get that in our email. And thanks to Adaptec, actually, for donating a wireless access point to us that works effectively. All of us geeks can get the email and take your call that way as well. Of course, just go to geekspeak.org. All right, Philip, we were just talking about the Gauss gun. Is that what it's referred to?
Rifle.
Okay, but basically it's a ruler with magnets on it and ball bearings. Now, what's going on here? Why is it so cool?
Well, if you're into high energy physics, you can make an accelerator for around $5 billion, or you can make one of these for about $30. And that's just magnets, a wooden ruler, plastic tape, and 9 steel balls. And basically, you construct this. So when one ball on the groove of the ruler hits the next one, you get a chain reaction, and each one goes faster, 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 and all the energy transfers to the last ball at the end, and you can shoot at a pretty neat target. Now, the neat thing is what I've heard from some people is, you know, kids really like building things that shoot stuff, and so kids are already taking this, of course, to the next level and trying to see how big they can or how long they can make this track with all of it. So apparently,
this could get dangerous at some point.
No, I don't know if it'd be dangerous. I think it's more dangerous than like a rubber band gun.
No, it's really cool because you're actually explaining physics.
Yeah,
science-based concepts to kids, and in a way that they can interact with it.
How long have they made it, Philip?
I think they're up to like 6 feet or something, and we're going to try to get some pictures of it.
Does it go? Do the balls go pretty fast at that point?
Yeah, I mean they're moving pretty fast. Yeah. I mean there is a limit with how fast these things can go, but it is pretty neat. I think. Just in general, as you were saying before, teaching physics to kids, this is the year of physics, 2005. It's been named by the Physics Association. And so I feel, you know, some of the articles in the magazine that deal with these type of topics at least helps that effort a little bit because, you know, that's one of the subjects that is sorely, sorely needed to get back into the the spotlight again, at least here in the U.S., as a major thing that kids should.
So it sounds like people are taking your articles and actually modifying them and expanding on them and getting back to you.
Yeah, that's what we found, is they're diving right into the remix culture, and they're taking the articles and they're saying, well, that's interesting, and I think that's kind of neat, and here's what I did, and they're letting us know about it. And a lot of the projects that people are making, are better than the ones that we even have, which is great. One of the things that I really liked is when people started doing reviews of the magazine, instead of just looking at it and saying, oh, this is a nice magazine or whatever, they actually built some of the projects to see if, we knew what we're talking about. And so one of the reviews, I think it was the San Francisco Chronicle, they built the $14 Steadicam project, where it was basically you can make your camera a Steadicam without having to pay, for the $10,000 version. And, you get pretty much the same results. And they posted a video of it online of what the camera is like before the Steadicam and what it's like after the Steadicam.
Something actually you can't do in print very easily.
Yeah, that was their review. They're like, this is great, look at this, and this is what we built. And
now, where'd they put that up? I mean, where is that available?
It's actually on the Make blog.
Okay.
We link to it right away, of course, because we're like, hey, look at this.
So that's one of the features of the Make blog, is that you're trying to help pull in other people that maybe do, reproduce the stuff in the magazine, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you thought about doing, like, contests and stuff of, the kind of thing where you're soliciting people to have input in? I know that the end of the magazine of last issue is a kind of a test for people. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we do have something called Makeshift, where we try to give people a puzzle. And this one was scenario, after relaxing of a night of camping deep in the woods, you return to your car and find out it will not start, the battery's dead, someone left the parking lights on overnight, you're 50 miles away from the nearest road and have limited food and water, you try to call for help, but your cell phone is out of power and out of range, no snowy weather is scheduled to set in, the situation is getting serious. And so you have some supplies, and then, we basically say, what do you do to get out of it? And we've had some really inventive solutions already. And, you can win a T-shirt. But we are going to expand the idea. Recently at eTech, we just had something called the Maker Fair. And there's some images on the magazine.com site where we had almost, it was like a science fair with beer. And we basically had 12 people showing off all sorts of different things from a water distiller, quote, water distiller, to making all sorts of different types of projects from battery chargers out of bicycles and all that. But we're going to probably expand that down the road. I mean, ideally, we'd like to have almost like blog meetups where people can go in and bring their electronics, the third Wednesday of every month, and all get together and talk about robots or, building electronics or just, doing things to make their computing life easier. So we're hoping that we can have these make-offs or whatever they're going to be called over time, and have contests and all that too.
Philip, what excites you about the success of this magazine, other than making sure you've got a job? What excites you about that people are taking this on and reading it and participating?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that we're not alone. And when I say we, I do mean the collective we. All these folks out there that like to tinker and look at their iPod and say, surely it can do more than just play music. Or, they're just curious about how things work, and they want to do things with the technology that they own. They want to remix their technology. They want to do something better with it, or just do something different. There's actually a lot of us out there. And the fact that a magazine like this is out there and people are embracing it encourages me to think that this might be a really big trend, and I do think it is, of people taking back their technology. I think back in when the AM radio was around, that was an entire generation of people that grew up with this AM radio, and later went on to build cell phone networks, and that was kind of the groundwork for all the great innovations we have now. So now we have kids with broadband and iPods. What's going to be the big innovation from this generation? So I think that a magazine like this might help that.
Is there something kind of exciting about it? Because, when you're talking about the early adoption of, like, radio, where people were making their own transistor radios or even tube radios prior to that, but when the transistor first came out and people were like, realized they can make their radio themselves and very easily, and a lot of people started doing that, there's a different level of involvement in the technology than when you just buy an iPod, for example. You're a producer and a creator, instead of just a consumer. And I think it's fascinating that even though at this point, you know, you can't really figure out how the processor is working without specs. I mean, you can't really cut it open and try to figure out what's going on and backwards engineer it. So there's some secrets going on. But at the same time, there are a lot of protocols and open source development packages and drivers and stuff for these things. And as long as you spend some time and know your kind of niche, you can do a lot more with the technology that's being provided as a consumer product. And I think that's pretty exciting to kind of break down that barrier of just a consumer and to create people that are remixers and makers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I keep my instant message screen name out there, and I probably get around 50 instant messages a week from kids who just want to change the firmware on their iPod to have different images. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't want the little flashing X that says do not disconnect. They want to put a picture on it, or they want to change the battery icon to look different, or they want to change the about screen to have their name. And I always point them at the articles I've written and, you know, walk them through it, because that's how you get started. You know, that's the first thing. And then the next thing, a percentage of them said, okay, that was kind of neat. What can I do next? And then I say, well, you can install Linux on it. And they're like, oh, really? What's that? And I point them over to the website. And then now they're installing Linux on it. And they're like, oh, what can I do? Well, you get all these new games, and you can record at high-quality audio and do all this other stuff. And then it's like, oh, wow, can I even write my own games? Sure you can. And, you know, then there you go. You have someone interested in programming and with a pretty big community of people behind it. So I think it's a good thing.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland and Drew Meyer. And Dee Dee Hubbard actually said goodbye to us silently. And we're speaking with Philip Terone, Make Magazine, and he's in Seattle. And you're welcome to join the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free in California at 1-800-655-5877. Or, of course, you can give us email by going to geekspeak.org and click on the Contact Us. And I'm going to open up the phone calls to any technical questions. We can answer questions about computers and technology. It sounds like Philip knows quite a bit about iPods, so if you'd like to call in with questions about MP3 players. Basically, call in with anything, any technical questions, and we will do our best to answer them. Again, in the 831 area code, it's 476-2800, or toll-free in California, it's 1-800-655-5877, or just go to our website, geekspeak.org, and give us an email. Sean and Drew, can you keep apprised of the email? Because I'm not right now.
We got it.
We got one yet?
I don't know yet. Hang on.
Okay, well, we do have a phone call coming in. So, Philip, I'll take
this. We have quite a few.
Quite a few? Okay, Sean, go ahead and grab us one of those. Philip, I want to ask you... how did you...
Actually, before you begin,
yeah.
One person wants to know, just restate the subject. He wants to make sure he knows what we're talking about.
Okay.
That's fair.
We're talking about Make Magazine. Make Magazine is a new magazine from O'Reilly. They're makers of software development books, if you will, programming books. And Make Magazine embraces this idea that people can do things themselves with technology, and it gives how-tos on projects and such. And you want to fill anything else with that, Philip?
Well, I would say it's kind of like National Geographic, Popular Science, and Wired all kind of rolled up in the one with all the stuff that you can do yourself with projects and technology that you probably have around the house.
What's this movement or process called? How would you Google this idea that people can do their own work?
I think just DIY, do it yourself, is something you see more and more, or just the term how-to. You know, there is, I think for the last 10 years, it was a lot of buy this, and now it's starting to become build this, or do this, or try this. And I think that's where you're starting to see a lot of content on websites. I mean, I don't think it's good enough to have a website about cell phones anymore. I think you have to have a website about cell phones that also tells you a little bit about how to use your phone. Making your own ringtones, you know, things like that. I don't think it's good enough just to sell some of these things anymore. They actually have to teach people and do things, because that's what they want.
And of course, if you're right now, if you want to, you know, find out more about what we're talking about, one of the greatest sources is the blog that Philip maintains at Make Magazine, make.oreilly.com, and you can go to geekspeak.org if you can't spell O'Reilly. And we're gonna go to Mike in Boulder Creek. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? I had a question, please, about shortened files and lossless audio.
Shortened files.
I was wondering if there's a player yet for shortened files.
I'm not familiar with the term shortened files. Geeks? Philip?
No, I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah.
Is this
is lossless audio where reproduction of digital media, it's MP3s are apparently lossy.
Yeah.
And so did the quality deteriorate through generations somewhat? Do you think that being digital that it would be identical or anyhow?
So Shorten is a lossless format.
Shorten, that's the extension .shn.
And do you use it?
Not so much yet. I'm without broadband, but looking forward to hopefully somebody developing a player for that.
Okay. Well,
yeah, you know, since I've got my iRiver, I stick with the formats that it supports. Aug is very nice.
Aug Vorbis.
Yeah,
that's cool.
I'm very impressed with that. File sizes aren't too big, and it sounds great.
I think one of the tricks in understanding how the portable player works is that there's a couple things going on. First off, your pipe of the weakest point is going to be the headsets you use. So if you get extremely good headsets and get almost, you know, lossless encodec, or basically you can take an MP3, you can create an MP3 file that has almost no loss, and it's very large file format. And I would bet that probably only, you know, 0.5% of the population could hear the difference between a clear, you know, really good headphones, a non, you know, lossless format file, and a really well encoded MP3. Philip, do you want to join in this?
Well, you know, a while ago I had heard about eTree.org, which I think is a clearinghouse that has all the files. I don't know what player. I use Audacity, which tends to open and play a lot of things you can throw at it, but I don't know specifically of a player that I could point them towards. But I would say probably a good Google search or search engine of your choice will probably yield some good players.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Good luck. Good luck on finding a player that can do that.
Now, we got a question from a listener. It's about, earlier we talked about Firefox 1.02, and we mentioned it as a patch. It's actually a full version of Firefox. Before you install it, you need to uninstall your current version. So make sure you do that first. In Windows, you would go to your control panel, click Add Remove Programs, remove Mozilla Firefox, and then install the new version.
Okay, there's an easier way to do it, Dee Dee says, and that is that you just use the software update built into Firefox. So you go to Options in Firefox and then go to Software Update, and it will just update it instead of reinstall. It's interesting because normally when I'm installing Firefox, you kind of just download, and on like a Macintosh environment, you download the application, just copy over, and that's it. So uninstalling from a Mac, for example, is just deleting an application and putting a new one in.
That's what I do in Windows. I just go to Program Files, go to Mozilla Firefox, delete the folder, and then reinstall.
And you're not losing your
don't lose your settings.
Your bookmarks and all that.
Right.
That's good. So there's two ways to do that. It's in the advanced tab.
Advanced tab. Great. That's good news. That's good to know.
We're going to go to Carmel. Dennis, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I don't know if this is mostly into the sort of the repair end of it, but I have a titanium PowerBook, one of the original ones that I ordered brand new 4 years ago, and now the screen is jumping all over the place, up and down, sort of a horizontal band. It hasn't gotten any worse, but it's really hard to look at. And Apple says, look, we're not going to help you out on this. It's 4 years old, and it's $1,200 to fix it. And somebody looked at it and said the firmware confirmed that it was a screen. It wasn't anything software. But is there any, I mean, $1,200, and I hate to throw it out, and obviously the only plausible way is just to buy a new computer. But is there anything I can do to salvage this thing? Is there anything, can I go in? Is there anything I can do?
You can do this. I mean, the $1,200, I'm assuming, is for someone else to fix it for you. It's possible that it's not really...
Could be a bad connection.
Could be a bad connection, bad soldering. It could be, I'm not sure, when you say it's flickering, normally, are you saying it's jumping up and down?
Yeah, kind of. It's from like horizontal bands, and the screen just kind of, jitters. It just up and down, horizontal.
Does it change as you
disconnection?
Does it change as you move the screen back and forth?
I've looked at it. I've tried it. It doesn't change a bit.
Okay, interesting.
It's not next to a magnet or anything.
Well, it's an LCD, so it wouldn't be
effective. You could plug it into an external monitor and see if that pattern or vertical line or horizontal line is reproducible. That would be an interesting test to see.
Are you getting that, Dennis?
I don't think. This thing won't support an external monitor.
A PowerBook? Sure.
The original PowerBook will?
When you say original PowerBook, can you describe the look of it? It's a titanium, right?
It's a titanium, 500 megahertz.
Yeah, on the right-hand, or on the back of it, when you flip down the little latch on the back, there should be a wide connector with a lot of pins. That's a connector for a monitor. It's not a VGA connector, but you can get a little adapter.
You can get a dongle.
The dongle actually came with your machine, so I'd go look at more stuff that you came with it, and you probably have a little dongle that connects a VGA monitor to it. And so what Philip's suggesting is if the reproduces on the
the monitor, then it's definitely an issue in, like, your video card inside the laptop.
Yeah, the chip
not,
on the board.
It's the LCD. Now, so what you would do is just get a cheap monitor and just use that instead of your LCD screen.
Yeah.
The other thing that I might do, it depends, well, maybe not, but basically the $1,200 is probably for someone else to fix this issue. I would definitely do some research to see if anyone else has fixed this issue and written it up. Our geek, John Tracy, wrote a great two-stage article on replacing the hinge in a titanium. The hinge had been broken. And in doing that, he references a few URLs that might be useful to you. You could, for example, buy, if you know it's the LCD, you could buy a replacement LCD and just replace the LCD itself yourself, and it would probably be cheaper.
Right.
That's a shot. But, yeah, I wouldn't spend $1,200, no way, because you can get a brand-new PowerBook for $1,200. Yeah. Good luck for the... Good luck on it.
And go ahead and send an email to the geeks. Go to geekspeak.org, and maybe John will have some advice for you, too.
And while you're there, check out the two articles on titanium repair. They'll definitely be an interesting read for you. All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
We're going to go to Santa Cruz, where we are now, to Chris. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, that actually kind of a recommendation for an issue of Make. For an article. I've been looking for, or trying to find out the most perhaps cost-efficient and easiest way to archive a significant amount of lossless music.
Mm-hmm. What's your source? Is it CDs or is it records?
Yeah, from CDs.
Okay.
And talking more than a terabyte.
Right. That's a lot. Why do you want it lossless?
Well, because if you do it as lossless, then you can convert to whatever formats might come up down the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can do that with any. You can do that with MP3 as well. You can convert later. It wouldn't be a problem.
But I meant to get rid of your CD. If you were planning on getting rid of CDs to save space and whatnot, and to save them all digitally.
How good are your ears?
Pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so is my stereo system.
Okay, I would do this. Do you have a computer?
Yes.
I would do this.
I'm on a Mac.
Take your CD. Okay, in the Mac, using iTunes, go into iTunes for where it's encoding, change that to the best quality possible. I think it's 192 kilobits, and do MP3. Then take a CD and burn it, if you will, or import it into iTunes. It will create MP3 files. Plug your computer into your stereo system and play that best quality, and then switch back to the CD and see if you can hear anything different. And I will bet you that you can't. And therefore, go with 192 kilobit MP3. Philip, are you going to support me on that?
Yeah, I think I do admire the idea of getting the best quality possible and storing it somewhere. I think that the moving target would always be what's the cheapest way to store physical stuff. And I think there's tons of fun solutions for that. I'm not quite sure if it'll ever, it'll always just be a price at the end, and the more you shop, the better, and the closer you'll get to finding the cheaper drive. But that's an interesting puzzle, because if you're not willing to go to MP3 or whatever format, if you just want it raw, I would say making backups of the CD itself would be cheaper.
Yeah, because what's going to happen is if you save your files as like WAV files from the CD, which is pretty much a copy of the file, and they're really big, it means basically each CD is going to be 650 megs of data, and then you get your hard drives to try to store that, you're talking about a massive investment in hard drives to store your terabytes of data. And therefore, is it worth it? Why not just burn copies of your CDs or keep copies of your CDs? And then you could also think that you'll always keep your CDs and just make MP3 copies to listen to, and if you ever want the best quality, you just get the original CD. There's that possibility. Sean, a couple things. Sean is suggesting that AAC is a better file.
ACC, DD.
ACC.
DD brought it up. And I've seen this before. I couldn't remember exactly what it was. It's a lossless audio format. Seems to be very popular right now.
It's MPEG-4. M4A, I think, is the file format, and is what DD's saying. And you can try that as the best quality, if you will, at this point. Here's a shot for you.
There's also a device, I don't know what your budget is, but there's a thing called a power file, which is basically a DVD or a CD-ROM carousel. It's FireWire-based. You can buy it and put it in your closet, and it holds 250 DVDs or CDs, and you can access it from your machine.
So you just never encode them, you just keep them on the CD?
If you're committed to keeping the CDs, yeah. It's not really the most space-efficient way, but it's a way to not have any loss at all.
Thank you, Chris, for the call.
So Phil, for your third issue on cars, I could tell you one device I would love for my car. A TiVo for my car stereo, my car radio.
Ah.
So when I'm listening to the radio and I miss something, I can back up and hear it again. Or if I, let's say, step out of my car to run into the store, I can come back out and continue listening to the show I was listening to where I left off.
I think there, I think that's possible. I think there's a couple low tech ways, and you can also buy the new XM MiFi, which actually supports.
Oh really? XM has that capability.
Has a hard drive or a caching device?
Is that just an XM or is that?
Yeah, it's. I think XM is the only one that has it right now. I bought one of these for my wife, and you can basically press pause or fast forward or rewind if it. Of course, if you.
Now, do you have to keep your car running?
No. You can. You can.
And is this only for XM content, or can you tune in traditional FM and AM?
Only for XM. It doesn't have any recording in. So that's why I think there's some interesting low-tech ways that you can do this, too.
Yeah, what is the XM device called?
It's called MiFi.
Huh. Yeah, we got to figure that out for regular radio.
Yeah, regular radio, I think you can do it. I think the low-tech solution might be an iPod running Linux, because I think you could actually get away with it that way if you had the audio coming in and then split it coming back out. And actually use the iPod as a temporary storage device. I think that might be a fun article, so I'll definitely look into it. I like that idea.
Our earlier caller, Dennis from Carmel, talked about the titanium notebook that has a monitor that's going out, and Dee says, yeah, it looks like it's a floor placement of the LCD, which is expensive and difficult to do. And she says, go ahead and sell it, sell the machine on eBay, get your data off and sell it on eBay, because people buy titaniums without monitors on eBay so they can make, like, home entertainment
centers.
Home
servers, yeah.
And,
or just keep it yourself as a home server.
Yeah, keep it yourself as a home center. It's always a nice thing. And then the AAC is the file form we're talking about, and it's Apple. There's AAC, and there's also Apple Lossless Encoder. Those are choices for you. We're running out of time quickly. We're not going to take any more calls. But, Philip, do you want to talk a little bit more about let me hear one more thing about your next issue. So first off, are you going to take Sean's suggestion and put it in the third issue of Make and do a radio TiVo?
I think I'm gonna look into it and see how approachable it is, and it'll likely appear either on the website or the magazine.
Oh,
I like
cool.
that idea. Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful.
I use an iRiver, not an iPod.
Oh, that's fine.
I can listen to FM on it.
Okay.
It already has that built in, so.
And I think you can record on those too, right?
Yes, exactly.
And the iRiver has some firmware patches and a pretty big community of people who are doing things, so that might be possible.
Do they actually have people modding firmware for those?
Yeah.
Oh, I got to look around some more.
With iRiver, the community is pretty big on.
And where do you find this iPod iRiver community that's doing this kind of stuff? Do you searches
iPod
on the web?
The iPod one is iPodWizard.net, I believe, and the iRiver one I'd have to do a Google search. But a lot of people are into just changing the graphics and then all the way to changing some of the functionality of the players.
Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Today, our guest, Philip Terone, is currently an associate editor at Make Magazine. He's an author and engineer based in Seattle and is an associate editor for Make, meaning that he does a lot for Make Magazine. He also runs, of course, the Make Magazine online version and the blog that's up there. He's authored and contributed numerous books on mobile devices, multimedia hacks, regular writes for Popular Science, mobile PC, as well as, of course, doing all the audio and video content on the Make Magazine or MakeZine.com site. Philip is also an internet strategy analyst for creative firm Falon Worldwide, best known for their award-winning work on BMW films. Philip, thank you very much for joining us on GeekSpeak today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Definitely. The geeks this morning, Miles Helam and John Tracy are not around, but Sean Cleveland and Drew Mayer and, of course, Dee Dee Hubbard join us for the first half of the show. Geeks, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Lau.
Thank you, Lau.
Our producer is Maggie Cleveland, and I appreciate her wholehearted efforts to support GeekSpeak continually. And all of you that listened to and called in and supported us by joining your voice or text to our show, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and, you know, who really wants to listen to that?
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 of Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Coming up next is Open Road, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Outer. We're on the web at kusp.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Terry Schiavo's parents are once again appealing a federal judge's ruling that has kept their brain-damaged daughter's feeding tube disconnected. From member station WUSF, Steve Newborn reports Bob and Mary Schindler's appeal to the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta came after another setback.
A U.S. District Court judge in Tampa denied their appeal for a new hearing based on what their attorney claims is medical evidence that Terry Schiavo's condition is improving. David Gibbs is the attorney for Schiavo's parents.
We talked about far more fundamental rights. Should people be given food and water? Or is that cruel and unusual?